In the tantric texts of medieval and modern India, the abode of the goddess is called Manidvipa, the island of jewels. Her couch and throne is there, in a grove of wish-fulfilling trees. The beaches of the isle are of golden sands. They are laved by the still waters of the ocean of the nectar of immortality. The goddess is red with the fire of life. The earth, the solar system, the galaxies of far-extending space all swell within her womb, for she is the world creatrix, ever mother, ever virgin. She encompasses the encompassing, nourishes the nourishing, and is the life of everything that lives. She is also the death of everything that dies. The whole round of existence is accomplished within her sway, from birth through adolescence, maturity, and senescence to the grave. She is the womb, she is the tomb, the sow that eats her farrow. Thus she unites the good and the bad, exhibiting the two modes of the remembered mother, not as personal only, but as universal. The devotee is expected to contemplate the two with equal equanimity. Through this exercise, his spirit is purged of its infantile, inappropriate sentimentalities and resentments, and his mind opened to the inscrutable presence which exists not primarily as good and bad, but as the law and image of the nature of being. Woman, in the picture language of mythology, represents the totality of what can be known. The hero is the one who comes to know. As he progresses in the slow initiation which is life, the form of the goddess undergoes for him a series of transfigurations. She can never be greater than himself, though she can always promise more than he is yet capable of comprehending. She lures, she guides, she bids him burst his fetters. And if he can match her import, the two, the knower and the known, will be released from every limitation. Woman is the guide to the sublime acme of sensuous adventure. By deficient eyes, she is reduced to inferior states. By the evil eye of ignorance, she is spellbound to banality and ugliness. But she is redeemed by the eyes of understanding. The hero who can take her as she is, without undue commotion, but with the kindness and assurance she requires, is potentially the king, the incarnate god of her created world. The meeting with the goddess, who is incarnate in every woman, is the final test of the talent of the hero to win the boon of love, which is life itself, enjoyed as the encasement of eternity. And when the adventurer in this context is not a youth, but a maid, she is the one who, by her qualities, her beauty, or her yearning, is fit to become the consort of an immortal. Then the heavenly husband descends to her and conducts her to his bed, whether she will or no. And if she has shunned him, the scales fall from her eyes. If she has sought him, her desire finds its peace. The king's daughter of the Frog Prince tale, on the day following the adventure at the well, heard a thumping at her castle door.
So she's sitting at table with Daddy, King Daddy, and Queen Mother, and little princess in the middle. And they're doing very well with their golden plates and all, when up the front steps comes plop, 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 and she goes white, bang on the door. And Daddy says, "What's that? You seem disturbed." I says, "Just a little frog I met." And Daddy says... Daddy represents the principles and demands of the world of society and virtue and all that. And Daddy says, "Make any promises?" He says, "Well, yes." Well, he says, "Let him in." So in comes this candidate, and he's on the floor. He says, "I want to sit at the table with you." Oh, so she puts him there, and I spoils that meal. So she goes upstairs, and he's up there after her, and she says, "You could stay down there." He says, "I want in. I want in the bed." Now, the story has two or three versions at this point. The one that I like is the one where she picks the frog up and simply hurls him at the wall. And when that happens to a frog, it's not normally good for him. But in this case, it splits in half, and there stands this beautiful prince with eyelashes like a camel. And the girl is enchanted. And the story says, and so they were married, and she introduced him next morning to Durrani. This is known in Sanskrit as a Gandharva marriage, the marriage of angels. No sooner is he introduced to Daddy than there is heard out under the porte cochere a coach drawing up, and it's the coach of the prince's land. Well, how come that this prince had become a frog? Anyone who's read his Freud knows why. He had been bewitched by a witch, who, as we know, is always mother. This is what had thrown him out down into the bottom of the well, and there he was as a frog now. And he finds his princess, his soul girl. He has gone down, so has she. This is where their divine marriage took place. And now there is revived the land. The coach comes to fetch them home. Now they've got an easy journey back. They're riding along the coach. It's being driven by a coachman whose name is Iron Henry. And they're going fine when they hear bang. And the prince says, "What's the matter, Henry? Did we break a spring?" "No," says Henry, "nothing of the kind. Ever since your departure, there have been four iron bands around my heart." This is the wasteland motif, the drowned man motif that Eliot speaks of in the wasteland. So bang, 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 there are three more bangs, and that means that the restricting, killing thing has been broken, and the elixir is simply the return of this fulfilled youth. It's an optimistic story, and I like it particularly because it has both ends. The girl's quest and the boy's quest are both brought together here. He has been thrown out. She has lost her own joy in life. And it's from the bottom of the well that their redemption comes.
Woman as the temptress. The mystical marriage with the queen goddess of the world represents the hero's total mastery of life. For the woman is life, the hero its knower and master. And the testings of the hero were symbolical of those crises of realization by which his consciousness came to be made capable of enduring the full possession of the mother destroyer, his inevitable bride. With what he knows that he and the father are one, he is in the father's place. Phrased in this way, the problem may sound remote from the affairs of normal human creatures. Nevertheless, every failure to cope with a life situation must be laid, in the end, to a restriction of consciousness. Wars and temper tantrums are the makeshifts of ignorance. Regrets are illuminations come too late. The whole sense of the myth of the hero's passage is that it shall serve as a general pattern for men and women wherever they may stand along the scale. The individual has only to discover his own position with reference to this general human formula, and let it then assist him past his restricting walls. Who and where are his ogres? Those are the reflections of the unsolved enigmas of his own humanity. What are his ideals? Those are the symptoms of his grasp of life. In the office of the modern psychoanalyst, the stages of the hero adventure come to light again in the dreams and hallucinations of the patient. Depth beyond depth of self-ignorance is fathomed, with the analyst in the role of the helper, the initiatory priest. And always, after the first thrills of getting underway, the adventure develops into a journey of disgust and phantasmagoric fears. The crux of the curious difficulty lies in the fact that our conscious views of what life ought to be seldom correspond to what life really is. Generally, we refuse to admit within ourselves or within our friends the fullness of that pushing, self-protective, malodorous, carnivorous, lecherous fever, which is the very nature of the organic cell. Rather, we tend to perfume, whitewash, and reinterpret, meanwhile imagining that all the flies in the ointment, all the hairs in the soup, are the faults of some unpleasant someone else. But when it suddenly dawns on us, or is forced to our attention, that everything we think or do is necessarily tainted with the odor of the flesh, there is a moment of revulsion. Life, the acts of life, the organs of life, woman in particular as the great symbol of life, become intolerable to the pure, pure soul. the innocent delight of Oedipus in his first possession of the queen turns to an agony of spirit when he learns who the woman is. Like Hamlet, he is beset by the moral image of the father. Like Hamlet, he turns from the fair features of the world to search the darkness for a higher kingdom than this of the incest and adultery-ridden, luxurious and incorrigible mother. The seeker of the life beyond life must press beyond her, surpass the temptations of her call, and soar to the immaculate ether beyond. Where this Oedipus-Hamlet revulsion remains to beset the soul, there the world, the body, and woman above all, become the symbols no longer of victory, but of defeat. A monastic, puritanical, world-negating ethical system then radically and immediately transfigures all the images of myth. No longer can the hero rest in innocence with the goddess of the flesh, for she has become the queen of sin. Atonement with the Father.
The second kind of crisis is that of father at one-ment, atonement. Now, this can be depicted as atonement, as it is in the biblical tradition where we are atoned with the Father, or as at-one-ment, when Christ says, I and the Father are one. The word atonement actually is made up of these two, and it has these two different meanings. This is the way in patriarchal mythologies, in which case, very often, the last test and temptation is that of a sexual temptation. The temptation of sex as the final temptation to be transcended, the ascetic tradition. These are the ways of the mythologies that we're most familiar with.
The bow of God's wrath is bent, and the arrow made ready on the string, and justice bends the arrow at your heart and strains the bow, and it is nothing but the mere pleasure of God, and that of an angry God, without any promise or obligation at all, that keeps the arrow one moment from being made drunk with your blood. With these words, Jonathan Edwards threatened his New England congregation by disclosing to them, unmitigated, the ogre aspect of the Father. The ogre aspect of the Father is a reflex of the victim's own ego, derived from the nursery, the fixating idolatry that is itself the fault that keeps one steeped in a sense of sin, sealing the potentially adult spirit from a better balanced, more realistic view of the Father and therewith of the world. Atonement, at-one-ment, consists in no more than the abandonment of that self-generated double monster, the dragon thought to be God, the superego, and the dragon thought to be sin, repressed id. But this requires an abandonment of the attachment to ego itself, and that is what's difficult. One must have a faith that the Father is merciful, and then a reliance on that mercy. Therewith, the center of belief is transferred outside of the bedeviling God's tight, scaly ring, and the dreadful ogres dissolve. It is in this ordeal that the hero may derive hope and assurance from the helpful female figure by whose magic he is protected through all the frightening experiences of the father's ego-shattering initiation. With that reliance for support, one endures the crisis, only to find in the end that the father and the mother reflect each other and are, in essence, the same. When the twin warriors of the Navajo, having departed from Spider Woman with her advice and protective charms, had made their perilous way between the rocks that crush, through the reeds that cut to pieces, and the cactus plants that tear to pieces, and then across the boiling sands, they came at last to the house of the sun, their father. The door was guarded by two bears. These arose and growled, but the words that Spider Woman had taught the boys made the animals crouch down again. After the bears, there threatened a pair of serpents, then winds, then lightnings, the guardians of the ultimate threshold. All were readily appeased, however, with the words of the prayer. Built of turquoise, the house of the sun was great and square, and it stood on the shore of a mighty water. The boys entered it, and they beheld a woman sitting in the west, two handsome young men in the south, two handsome young women in the north. The young woman stood up without a word, wrapped the newcomers in four sky coverings, and placed them on a shelf. The boys lay quietly. Presently, a rattle hanging over the door shook four times, and one of the young women said, "Our father is coming." The bearer of the sun strode into his home, removed the sun from his back, and hung it on a peg on the west wall of the room, where it shook and clanged for some time, going, "Tla, tla, tla, tla." He returned to the older woman and demanded angrily, "Who were those two that entered here today?" But the woman did not reply. The young people looked at one another. The bearer of the sun put his question angrily four times before the woman said to him at last, "It would be well for you not to say too much. Two young men came hither today seeking their father. You have told me that you pay no visits when you go abroad and that you have met no woman but me. Whose sons then are these?" She pointed to the bundle on the shelf, and the children smiled significantly at one another. The bearer of the sun took the bundle from the shelf, unrolled the four robes, the robes of dawn, blue sky, yellow evening light, and darkness, and the boys fell out on the floor. He immediately seized them. Fiercely he flung them at some great sharp spikes of white shell that stood in the east. The boys tightly clutched their life feathers and bounded back. The man hurled them equally hard at the spikes of turquoise in the south, Haliotis in the west, and black rock in the north. The boys always clutched their life feathers lightly and came bounding back. "I wish it were indeed true," said the sun, "that they were my children." The terrible father then tried to steam the boys to death in an overheated sweat lodge. They were aided by the winds, who provided a protected retreat within the lodge in which to hide. "Yes, these are my children," said the sun when they emerged. But that was only a ruse, for he was still planning to trick them. The final ordeal was a smoking pipe filled with poison. A spiny caterpillar warned the boys and gave them something to put into their mouths. They smoked the pipe without harm, passing it back and forth to one another till it was finished. They even said then it tasted sweet. The son was proud. He was completely satisfied. "Now, my children," he asked, "what is it you want from me? Why do you seek me?" The twin heroes had won the full confidence of the son, their father. When the child outgrows the popular idol of the mother breast and turns to face the world of specialized adult action, it passes spiritually into the sphere of the father, who becomes, for his son, the sign of the future task, and for his daughter, the sign of the future husband. Whether he knows it or not, and no matter what his position in society, the father is the initiating priest through whom the young being passes on into the larger world. And just as formerly the mother represented the good and evil, so now does he, but with this complication, that there is a new element of rivalry in the picture, the son against the father for the mastery of the universe, and the daughter against the mother to be the mastered world. The traditional idea of initiation combines an introduction of the candidate into the duties and privileges of his vocation and into a radical readjustment of his emotional relationship to the parental images. The mystagogue, father or father substitute, is to entrust the symbols of office only to a son who has been purged of all inappropriate infantile cathexes and for whom the exercise of such powers will not be rendered impossible by unconscious motives of self-aggrandizement or resentment. Ideally, the invested one has been divested of his mere humanity and is representative of an impersonal cosmic force. He is the twice-born. He has become himself, the father, and he is competent, consequently, now to enact himself the role of the initiator, the guide, the sundor, through whom one may pass from the infantile illusions of good and evil to an experience of the mystery of cosmic law, purged of hope and fear, and at peace in the understanding of the revelation of being. The paradox of creation, the coming of the forms of time out of eternity, is the germinal secret of the Father. It can never be quite explained. Therefore, in every system of theology, there is an umbilical point, an Achilles tendon, which the finger of mother life has touched, and where the possibility of perfect knowledge has been impaired. The problem of the hero is to pierce himself and therewith his world precisely through that point, to shatter and annihilate that key knot of his limited existence. The problem of the hero going to meet the father is to open his soul beyond terror, to to such a degree that he will be ripe to understand how the insane tragedies of this ruthless cosmos are completely validated in the majesty of being. The hero transcends life with its peculiar blind spot and for a moment rises to a glimpse of the source. He beholds the face of the Father, understands, and the two are atoned. In the biblical story of Job, the Lord makes no attempt to justify in human or any other terms the ill pay meted out to his virtuous servant.
God behaved like a monster to Job. This was a perfectly ruthless, atrocious job. His friend the devil comes and says, "You think Job is a good man and respects you. That's because you've been good to him. But you treat him badly and watch." God says, "I'll bet." And it was on. And then they started to work on this poor man, and you know what happened. House gone, family gone, everything gone, health gone. He ends up on a pile of ashes with a case of bad boils and so forth. And his friends come to him and say, "Job, you must really have been bad to be punished this way." And he said, "Nothing of the kind, I haven't." And he was right. And the point was, he was punished not because he was bad, but because he was good. And finally, his insistence on the fact that he had not misbehaved brought God himself to show himself. And what did God say? Did he say, "Look here, you've been great, Job. I had this bet and I've won"? No, he didn't say that. Nor did he try by any roundabout rationalization to explain this things in decent terms. It was an indecent act. He simply said, "Are you big? Could you fill Leviathan's nose with harpoons? I did. Try it. See how you can do. Who are you, you little worm, to address yourself to the problem of what I'm doing?" And Job abdicates his human judgment and says, "O Lord, who is man that thou shouldst regard him? I have heard of thee with mine ears. I behold thee with mine eyes. I put ashes on my head. I'm ashamed." That is the submission of the human judgment to the divine mystery.
There is no word of explanation, no mention of the dubious wager with Satan described in chapter 1 of the book of Job, only a thunder and lightning demonstration of the fact of facts, namely that man cannot measure the will of God, which derives from a center beyond the range of human categories. Nevertheless, to Job himself, the revelation appears to have made soul-satisfying sense. He was a hero who, by his courage in the fiery furnace, his unreadiness to break down and grovel before a popular conception of the character of the All-Highest, had proven himself capable of facing a greater revelation than the one that satisfied his friends. "I have heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now mine eye seeth thee. Wherefore I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes." The pious comforters are humbled. Job is rewarded with a fresh house, fresh servants, and fresh daughters and sons. After this lived Job 140 years, and saw his sons and his sons' sons even 4 generations. So Job died, being old and full of days. For the son who has really grown to know the Father, the agonies of the ordeal are readily borne. The world is no longer a veil of tears, but a bliss-yielding, perpetual manifestation of the presence. Apotheosis.
The third way
is what I call apotheosis, where the hero realizes that he is the divine being himself. This is the way of the Buddha, who becomes the Buddha. He isn't atoned with any father. He isn't united with any goddess. He realizes, tatvamasi, thou art that, I am that. That is full realization. These are the 3 high modes of realization symbolized in the high religions.
One of the most powerful and beloved of the bodhisattvas of the Mahayana Buddhism of Tibet, China, and Japan is the lotus bearer, the Lord looking down in pity, so called because he regards with compassion all sentient creatures suffering the evils of existence. To him goes the million-fold repeated prayer of the prayer wheels and the temple gongs of Tibet. Om Mani Padme Hum, The jewel is in the lotus. To him go perhaps more prayers per minute than to any single divinity known to man. For when, during his final life on earth as a human being, he shattered the bounds of the last threshold, he paused. He made a vow that before entering the void, he would bring all creatures without exception to enlightenment, so that the least prayer addressed to him throughout the vast spiritual empire of the Buddha is graciously heard. He reveals himself in human form with two arms, in superhuman forms with four arms, or with six, or 12, or 1,000, and he holds in one of his left hands the lotus of the world. Like the Buddha himself, this godlike being is a pattern of the divine state to which the human hero attains who has gone beyond the last terrors of ignorance. As the Prajnaparamita Hridaya Sutra states, when the envelopment of consciousness has been annihilated, then he becomes free of all fear, beyond the reach of change. This is the release potential within us all, and which anyone can attain through herohood. For as we read, all things are Buddha things, or again, and this is the other way of making the same statement, all beings are without self. In China and Japan, this sublimely gentle bodhisattva is represented not only in male form, but also as female. Kuan Yin of China, Kwannon of Japan, the Madonna of the Far East, is precisely this benevolent regarder of the world. She will be found in every Buddhist temple of the farthest Orient. She is blessed alike to the simple and to the wise, for behind her vow there lies a profound intuition, world-redeeming, world-sustaining. The first wonder to be noted here is the androgynous character of the bodhisattva. Male-female gods are not uncommon in the world of myth. They emerge always with a certain mystery, for they conduct the mind beyond objective experience into a symbolic realm where duality is left behind. Awona Wilona, chief guide of the Pueblo of Zuni, the maker and container of all, is sometimes spoken of as he, but is actually he-she. The great original of the Chinese chronicles, the holy woman Tai Yuan, combined in her person the masculine yang and the feminine yin. The Kabbalistic teachings of the medieval Jews, as well as the Gnostic teachings of Christianity in the second century, represent the Word made flesh as androgynous, which was indeed the state of Adam as he was created before the female aspect, Eve, was removed into another form. And among the Greeks, not only Hermaphrodite, the child of Hermes and Aphrodite, but Eros too, the divinity of love, the first of the gods, according to Plato, were in sex both female and male. The bisexual god is the mystery of the theme of initiation. We are taken from the mother, chewed into fragments, and assimilated to the world-annihilating body of the ogre for whom all the precious forms and beings are only the courses of a feast. But then, miraculously reborn, we are more than we were. If the god is a tribal, racial, national, or sectarian archetype, we are the warriors of his cause. But if he is a lord of the universe itself, we then go forth as knowers to whom all men are brothers. And in either case, the childhood parent images and ideas of good and evil have been surpassed. We no longer desire and fear, we are what was desired and feared. This is the sense of the first wonder of the bodhisattva, the androgynous character of the presence. Therewith, the two apparently opposite mythological adventures come together, the meeting with the goddess and the atonement with the father. For in the first, the initiate learns that male and female are two halves of a split pea, where in the second, the father is found to be antecedent to the division of sex. The pronoun he was a manner of speech, the myth of sonship a guiding line to be erased. And in both cases it is found, or rather recollected, that the hero himself is that which he had come to find. The second wonder to be noted in the bodhisattva myth is its annihilation of the distinction between life and release from life, which is symbolized in the bodhisattva's renunciation of nirvana. Briefly, nirvana means the extinguishing of the threefold fire of desire, hostility, and delusion. In the legend of the temptation under the Bo tree, the antagonist of the future Buddha was Kamamara, literally desire, hostility, or love and death, the magician of delusion. He was a personification of the threefold fire and of the difficulties of the last test, a final threshold guardian to be passed by the universal hero on his supreme adventure to nirvana. Having subdued within himself the threefold fire, which is the moving power of the universe, the Savior beheld reflected as in a mirror all around him the last projected fantasies of his primitive physical will to live like other human beings, the will to live according to the normal motives of desire and hostility. And this was the moment on which all depended, for from one coal could arise again the whole conflagration.
Now the legend with respect to Bodhisattva is that as he was about to deliquesce, you know, in the last rapture of nirvanic realization and no longer return to the world in the round of rebirths, he heard the clouds and trees and rocks and all send up a cry of lament. And he asked, why this? And the cry was then explained. They said that your presence here has given us a realization of the imminence of nirvana, and your departure will deprive us of this. And so he resolved to remain in the world, to keep coming back, not to leave, but to represent the imminence of nirvana in the world. Now that's the meaning of that Tibetan saying, Om Mani Padme Hum. Mani Padme means the jewel is in the lotus, the jewel of nirvanic realization, that is to say the dimension of mystery, the dimension of consubstantiality, the dimension of illumination is right imminent here. This is the golden lotus world, whether you see it as such or not. In its horror, in its banality, in its cruelty, in its lust, this is the nirvanic world. And it's not to be corrected. It can't be corrected. What is to be corrected is your optical dress. So unless you can see that, you will not realize that it's operative here. Now, this one whose being is illumination. Bodhi means illumination. Sattva means being. He whose being, Sattva, is illumination, remains in the world. And the notion is that he operates through us in our consorting with each other. Whether we are intentionally striving to illuminate each other or not, we are doing so all the time. And this is the operation of Avalokiteshvara's compassion, karuna, in the world. He is depicted always with a kingly crown, as each of us is depicted, so to say, with the signs of our function in society, our role in society, and through our functioning that way, we are incarnations of that principle of Avalokiteshvara, each in his own dimension. So this idea of the mysticism that is that of the person in the world, doing his duty in the world, not thinking of himself with a kind of longer neck and higher locus, but just humbly and simply doing his work, that is a mystical work also. And it's the mystical way of the Bodhisattva.
This greatly celebrated legend affords an excellent example of the close relationship maintained in the Orient between myth, psychology, and metaphysics. There is a certain resemblance of this ancient mythological doctrine of the dynamics of the psyche to the teachings of the modern Freudian school. According to the latter, the life wish, eros or libido, corresponding to the Buddhist kama, desire, and the death wish, thanatos or destrudo, which is identical with the Buddhist mara, or hostility or death, are the two drives that not only move the individual from within, but also animate for him the surrounding world. Moreover, the unconsciously grounded delusions from which desires and hostilities arise are in both systems dispelled by psychological analysis and illumination. Yet the aims of the two teachings, the traditional and the modern, are not exactly the same. Psychoanalysis is a technique to cure excessively suffering individuals of the unconsciously misdirected desires and hostilities that weave around them their private webs of unreal terrors. The patient, released from these, finds himself able to participate with comparative satisfaction in the more realistic fears, hostilities, erotic and religious practices, business enterprises, wars, pastimes, and household tasks offered to him by his particular culture. But for the one who has deliberately undertaken the difficult and dangerous journey beyond the village compound, these interests, too, are to be regarded as based on error. Therefore, The aim of the religious teaching is not to cure the individual back again to the general delusion, but to detach him from delusion altogether. Not by readjusting the desire and hostility, for that would only originate a new context of delusion, but by extinguishing the impulses to the very root, according to the celebrated Buddhist Eightfold Path. Right belief, right intentions. Right speech, right actions. Right livelihood, right endeavoring, right mindfulness, right concentration. The Bodhisattva, however, does not abandon life. Turning his regard from the inner sphere of thought-transcending truth, which can be described only as emptiness, outward again to the phenomenal world, he perceives without the same ocean of being that he found within. From the Prajnaparamita Hridaya Sutra we read, "Form is emptiness, emptiness form. Emptiness is not different from form, form is not different from emptiness. What is form is emptiness, what is emptiness form, and the same applies to perception, name, conception, and knowledge." Having surpassed the delusions of his formerly self-assertive, self-defensive, self-concerned ego, he knows without and within the same repose. What he beholds without is the visual aspect of the emptiness on which his own experiences of ego, perceptions, and knowledge ride. And he is filled with compassion for the self-terrorized beings who live in fright of their own nightmare. He rises, returns to them, and dwells with them as an egoless center through whom the principle of emptiness is made manifest in its own simplicity. And this is his great compassionate act, for by it the truth is revealed that in the understanding of one in whom the threefold fire of desire, hostility, and delusion is dead, this world is nirvana. Gift waves go out from such a one for the liberation of all. And so it may be said that the modern therapeutic goal of the cure back to life is attained through the ancient religious discipline. Those who know not only that the everlasting lives in them, but that what they and all things really are is the everlasting, dwell in the groves of the wish-fulfilling trees, drink the brew of immortality, and listen everywhere to the unheard music of eternal concord. These are the immortals. The ultimate boon.
There is a fourth motif, which is that of many of the most popular and vivid myths. It is that of the fire or bride theft. Prometheus stealing the fire from the guardians, male or female. This represents a kind of violence. You have come with the purpose of achieving one aspect of the total goal. You grab it, and not having appeased all the forces on the way down, you become assailed then by those unpropitiated powers. And there is then necessary a flight. This is the way of quest. That's the first half of the story.
When the prince of the lonesome island had remained 6 nights and days on the golden couch with the sleeping queen of Tubbertintay, the couch resting on wheels of gold and the wheels turning continually, the couch going round and round, never stopping night or day, on the 7th morning he said, "It is time for me now to leave this place." So he came down and filled the 3 bottles with water from the flaming well. In the golden chamber was a table of gold, and on the table a leg of mutton with a loaf of bread. And if all the men of Erin were to eat for a 12th month from the table, the mutton and the bread would be in the same form after the eating as before. The prince sat down, ate his fill of the loaf and the leg of mutton, and left them as he had found them. Then he rose up, took his 3 bottles, put them in his wallet, and was leaving the chamber when he said to himself, "It would be a shame to go away without leaving something by which the queen may know who was here while she slept." So he wrote a letter saying that the son of the king of Erin and the queen of the lonesome island had spent 6 days and nights in the golden chamber of Tubbertintay, had taken away 3 bottles of water from the flaming well, and had eaten from the table of gold. Putting his letter under the pillow of the queen, he went out, stood in the open window, sprang on the back of the lean and shaggy little horse, and passed the trees and the river unharmed. The ease with which the adventure is here accomplished signifies that the hero is a superior man, a born king. Such ease distinguishes numerous fairy tales and all legends of the deeds of incarnate gods. Where the usual hero would face a test, the elect encounters no delaying obstacle and makes no mistake. The well is the world navel, its flaming water the indestructible essence of existence, the bed going round and round being the world axis. The sleeping castle is that ultimate abyss to which the descending consciousness submerges in dream, where the individual life is on the point of dissolving into undifferentiated energy. And it would be death to dissolve, yet death also to lack the fire. The motif, derived from an infantile fantasy of the inexhaustible dish, symbolizes the perpetual, life-giving, form-building powers of the universal source. It is a fairy tale counterpart of the mythological image of the cornucopian banquet of the gods. While the bringing together of the two great symbols of the meeting with the goddess and the fire theft reveals with simplicity and clarity the status of the anthropomorphic powers in the realm of myth. They are not ends in themselves, but guardians, embodiments, or bestowers of the liquor, the milk, the food, the fire, the grace of indestructible life. The gods and goddesses, then, are to be understood as embodiments and custodians of the elixir of imperishable being, but not themselves the ultimate in its primary state. What the hero seeks through his intercourse with them is therefore not finally themselves, but their grace, the power of their sustaining substance. This miraculous energy substance, and this alone, is the imperishable. The names and forms of the deities who everywhere embody, dispense, and represent it come and go. This is the miraculous energy of the thunderbolts of Zeus, Yahweh, and the Supreme Buddha, the fertility of the reign of Viracocha, the virtue announced by the bell rung in the Mass at the consecration, and the light of the ultimate illumination of the saint and sage. Its guardians dare release it only to the duly proven. The Japanese have a proverb, "The gods only laugh when men pray to them for wealth." The boon bestowed on the worshipper is always scaled to his stature and to the nature of his dominant desire. The boon is simply a symbol of life energy, stepped down to the requirements of a certain specific case. The irony, of course, lies in the fact that whereas the hero who has won the favor of the god may beg for the boon of perfect illumination, what he generally seeks are longer years to live, weapons with which to slay his neighbor, or the health of his child. The agony of breaking through personal limitations is the agony of spiritual growth. Art, literature, myth, and cult, philosophy, and ascetic disciplines are instruments to help the individual past his limiting horizons into spheres of ever-expanding realization. As he crosses threshold after threshold, conquering dragon upon dragon, the stature of the divinity that he summons to his highest wish increases until it subsumes the cosmos. Finally, the mind breaks the bounding sphere of the cosmos to a realization transcending all experiences of form, all symbolizations, all divinities, a realization of the ineluctable void. The pagan divinity Odin gave an eye to split the veil of light into the knowledge of this infinite dark, and then underwent for it the passion of a crucifixion. From the poetic Edda, Odin speaks, "I know I hung on that windswept tree, hung there for 9 long nights. With the spear I was wounded, and offered I was to Odin, myself to myself, on the tree that none may ever know whither the roots of it run." The Buddha's victory beneath the bow tree is the classic Oriental example of this deed. With the sword of his mind, he pierced the bubble of the universe, and it shattered to naught. The whole world of natural experience, as well as the continents, heavens, and hells of traditional religious belief, exploded together with their gods and demons. But the miracle of miracles was that though all exploded, all was nevertheless thereby renewed. Indeed, the gods of the redeemed heavens raised their voices in harmonious acclaim of the man hero who had penetrated beyond them to the void that was their life and source. And now we turn to the last stage of the hero's journey, the return, beginning with refusal of the return. When the hero quest has been accomplished through penetration to the source or through the grace of some male or female, human or animal personification, the adventurer still must return with his life-transmuting trophy. The full round requires that the hero shall now begin the labor of bringing the runes of wisdom, the golden fleece, or his sleeping princess back into the kingdom of humanity, where the boon may redound to the renewing of the community, the nation, the planet, or the 10,000 worlds. But the responsibility has been frequently refused. Even the Buddha, after his triumph, doubted whether the message of realization could be communicated, and saints are reported to have passed away while in the supernal ecstasy. Numerous indeed are the heroes fabled to have taken up residence forever in the blessed isle of the unaging goddess of immortal being. A moving tale is told of an ancient Hindu warrior king named Muchukunda. He was born from his father's left side, the father having swallowed by mistake a fertility potion that the Brahmins had prepared for his wife. And in keeping with the promising symbolism of this miracle, the motherless marvel, fruit of the male womb, grew to be such a king among kings that when the gods at one period were suffering defeat in their perpetual contest with the demons, they called upon him for help. He assisted them to a mighty victory, and they, in their divine pleasure, granted him the realization of his highest wish. But what should such a king, himself almost omnipotent, desire? What greatest boon of boons could be conceived of by such a master among men? King Muchukunda was very tired after his battle. All he asked was that he might be granted a sleep without end, and that any person chancing to arouse him should be burned to a crisp by the first glance of his eye. The boon was bestowed. In a cavern chamber, deep within the womb of a mountain, King Muchukunda retired to sleep, and there slumbered through the revolving eons. Individuals, peoples, civilizations, world ages came into being out of the void and dropped back into it again, while the old king, in his state of subconscious bliss, endured. Timeless as the unconscious, that old mountain man, the drinker of deep sleep, lived on and on. His awakening came, but with a surprising turn that throws into new perspective the whole problem of the hero circuit, as well as the mystery of a mighty king's request for sleep as the highest conceivable boon. Vishnu, the lord of the world, had become incarnate in the person of a beautiful youth named Krishna, who, having saved the land of India from a tyrannical race of demons, had assumed the throne. And he had been ruling in utopian peace when a horde of barbarians suddenly invaded from the northwest. Krishna, the king, went against them, but in keeping with his divine nature, won the victory playfully by a simple ruse. Unarmed and garlanded with lotuses, he came out of his stronghold and tempted the enemy king to pursue and catch him, then dodged into a cave. When the barbarian followed, he discovered someone lying there in the chamber, asleep. "Oh," thought he, "so he has lured me here and now feigns to be a harmless sleeper." He kicked the figure lying on the ground before him, and it stirred. It was King Muchukunda. The figure rose, and the eyes that had been closed for unnumbered cycles of creation, world history, and dissolution opened slowly to the light. The first glance that went forth struck the enemy king, who burst into a torch of flame and was reduced immediately to a smoking heap of ash. Muchukunda turned, and the second glance struck the garlanded, beautiful youth, whom the awakened old king straightway recognized by his radiance as an incarnation of God. And Muchukunda bowed before his Savior with the following prayer: "My Lord God, when I lived and wrought as a man, I lived and wrought, straying restlessly through many lives, birth after birth I sought and suffered, nowhere knowing cease or rest. Distress I mistook for joy, mirages appearing over the desert I mistook for refreshing waters, delights I grasped, and what I obtained was misery. Kingly power and earthly possession, riches and might, friends and sons, wife and followers, everything that lures the senses, I wanted them all, because I believed that these would bring me beatitude. But the moment anything was mine, it changed its nature and became as a burning fire. Then I found my way into the company of the gods, and they welcomed me as a companion. But where still, surcease? Where rest? The creatures of this world, gods included, are all tricked, my Lord God, by your playful ruses. That is why they continue in their futile round of birth, life agony, old age and death. Between lives, they confront the Lord of the dead and are forced to endure hells of great degree of pitiless pain, and it all comes from you. My Lord God, deluded by your playful ruses, I too was a prey of the world, wandering in a labyrinth of error, netted in the meshes of ego consciousness. Now, therefore, I take refuge in your presence, the boundless, the adorable, desiring only freedom from it all. When Muchukunda stepped from his cave, he saw that men, since his departure, had become reduced in stature. He was as a giant among them, and so he departed from them again, retreated to the highest mountains, and there dedicated himself to the ascetic practices that should finally release him from his last attachment to the forms of being. Muchukunda, in other words, instead of returning, decided to retreat one degree still further from the world. And who shall say that his decision was altogether without reason? The Magic Flight.
Now comes the way of return. Dante went through the three worlds, but came back and wrote about it. If this has been the mode of achievement, we will have flight, what's called the magic flight. Or we may have a return that is protected by the powers. Return. You know the magic flight, it's very favorite of the fairy tales. The hero or little Hansel and Gretel or somebody like this are running away from a pursuing monster, and they throw things over their shoulder. They throw a comb over, it becomes a forest, and the monster coming comes through, until finally we get to the threshold again, back to the light world, and you're out.
If the hero in his triumph wins the blessing of the goddess or the god, and is then explicitly commissioned to return to the world with some elixir for the restoration of society, the final stage of his adventure is supported by all the powers of his supernatural patron. On the other hand, if the trophy has been attained against the opposition of its guardian, or if the hero's wish to return to the world has been resented by the gods or demons, then the last stage of the mythological round becomes a lively, often comical pursuit. This flight may be complicated by marvels of magical obstruction and evasion. The Buryats of Irkutsk in Siberia, for example, declare that Morgan Kara, their first shaman, was so competent that he could bring back souls from the dead. And so the Lord of the Dead complained to the High God of Heaven, and God decided to pose the shaman a test. He got possession of the soul of a certain man and slipped it into a bottle, covering the opening with the ball of his thumb. The man grew ill, and his relatives sent for Morgan Kara. The shaman looked everywhere for the missing soul. He searched the forest, the waters, the mountain gorges, the land of the dead, and at last mounted sitting on his drum to the world above, where again he was forced to search for a long time. Presently, he observed that the High God of Heaven was keeping a bottle covered with the ball of his thumb, and studying the circumstance, perceived that inside the bottle was the very soul he had come to find. The wily shaman changed himself into a wasp. He flew at God and gave him such a hot sting on the forehead that the thumb jerked from the opening and the captive got away. Then, the next thing God knew, there was this shaman, Morgan Kara, sitting on his drum again and going down to earth with the recovered soul. The flight in this case, however, was not entirely successful. Becoming terribly angry, God immediately diminished the power of the shaman forever by splitting his drum in two. And so that is why shaman drums, which originally, according to this story of the Buryat, were fitted with two heads of skin, from that day to this, have had only one. One of the most shocking of the obstacle flights is that of the Greek hero Jason. He had set forth to win the Golden Fleece. Putting to sea in the magnificent ship Argo, with a great company of warriors, he had sailed in the direction of the Black Sea, and though delayed by many fabulous dangers, arrived at last, miles beyond the Bosphorus, at the city and palace of King Aeetes. Behind the palace was the grove and tree of the dragon-guarded prize. Now the daughter of the king, Medea, conceived an overpowering passion for the illustrious foreign visitor, and when her father imposed an impossible task as the price of the Golden Fleece, compounded charms that enabled him to succeed. The task was to plow a certain field, employing bulls of flaming breath and brazen feet, then to sow the field with dragon's teeth and slay the armed men who should immediately spring into being. But with his body and armor anointed with Medea's charm, Jason mastered the bulls, and when the army sprang from the dragon seed, he tossed a stone into their midst, which turned them face to face. and they slew each other to the man. The infatuated young woman conducted Jason to the oak from which hung the fleece. The guarding dragon was distinguished by a crest, a three-forked tongue, and nastily hooked fangs. But with the juice of a certain herb, the couple put the formidable monster to sleep. Then Jason snatched the prize. Medea ran with him, and the Argo put to sea. But the king was soon in swift pursuit, and when Medea perceived that his sails were cutting down their lead, she persuaded Jason to kill Apsyrtus, her younger brother, whom she had carried off, and tossed the pieces of the dismembered body into the sea. This forced King Aetes, her father, to put about, rescue all the fragments, and go ashore to give them decent burial. Meanwhile, the Argo ran with the wind and passed from his ken. The Greek myth of Orpheus and Eurydice, and hundreds of analogous tales throughout the world, suggest that in spite of the failure recorded, a possibility exists of a return of the lover with his lost love from beyond the terrible threshold. It is always some little fault, some slight yet critical symptom of human frailty that makes impossible the open interrelationship between the worlds, so that one is tempted to believe almost that if the small, marring incident could be avoided, all would be well. In the Polynesian versions of the romance, however, where the fleeing couple usually escape, and in the Greek satyr play of Alcestis, where we also have a happy return, the effect is not reassuring, but only superhuman. The myths of failure touch us with the tragedy of life, but those of success only with their own incredibility. And yet, if the monomyth is to fulfill its purpose, not human failure or superhuman success, but human success is what shall have to be shown. That is the problem of the crisis of the threshold of the return. We shall first consider it in the superhuman symbols, and then seek the practical teaching for historic man. Rescue from without. The hero may have to be brought back from his supernatural adventure by assistance from without. That is to say, the world may have to come and get him. For the bliss of the deep abode is not lightly abandoned. Society is jealous of those who remain away from it and will come knocking at the door. If the hero, like King Muchukunda, is unwilling, the disturber suffers an ugly shock. But on the other hand, if the summoned one is only delayed, sealed in by the beatitude of the state of perfect being, which resembles death, an apparent rescue is effected, and the adventurer returns. When Raven of the Eskimo tale had darted with his fire sticks into the belly of the whale cow, he discovered himself at the entrance of a handsome room, at the farther end of which burned a lamp. He was surprised to see sitting there a beautiful girl. The room was dry and clean, the whale's spine supporting the ceiling and the ribs forming the walls. From a tube that ran along the backbone, oil dripped slowly into the lamp. When Raven entered the room, the woman looked up and cried, "How did you get here? You are the first man ever to enter this place." Raven told what he had done, and she bade him take a seat on the opposite side of the room. This woman was the soul, Inua, of the whale. She spread a meal before the visitor, gave him berries and oil, and told him meanwhile how she had gathered the berries the year before. Raven remained 4 days as guest of the Inua in the belly of the whale, and during the entire period was trying to ascertain what kind of tube that could be running along the ceiling. Every time the woman left the room, she forbade him to touch it, but now, when she again went out, he walked over to the lamp, stretched out his claw, and caught on it a big drop, which he licked off with his tongue. It was so sweet that he repeated the act, and then proceeded to catch drop after drop as fast as they fell. Presently, however, his greed found this too slow, so he reached up, broke off a piece of the tube, and ate it. Hardly had he done so when a great gush of oil poured into the room, extinguished the light, and the chamber itself began to roll heavily back and forth. This rolling went on for 4 days. Raven was almost dead with fatigue and with the terrible noise that stormed around him all the while. But then everything quieted down, and the room lay still. For Raven had broken one of the heart arteries, and the whale cow had died. The Inua never returned. The body of the whale was washed ashore. But now Raven was a prisoner. While he pondered what he should do, he heard two men talking up on the back of the animal, and they decided to summon all the people from the village to help with the whale. Very soon, they had a hole cut in the upper part of the great body. When it was large enough, and all the people had gone off with pieces of meat to carry them high up on the shore, Raven stepped out unnoticed. But no sooner had he reached the ground than he remembered he had left his fire sticks within. He took off his coat and mask and pretty soon the people saw a small black man wrapped up in a queer animal skin approaching them. They looked at him curiously. The man offered to help, rolled up his sleeves, and set to work. In a little while, one of the people working in the interior of the whale shouted, "Look what I have found! Fire sticks in the belly of the whale!" Raven said, "My, but this is bad. My daughter once told me that when fire sticks are found inside a whale that people have cut open, many of those people will die. I'm for running." He rolled down his sleeves again and made away. The people hurried to follow his example. And so that was how Raven, who then doubled back, had for a time the whole feast to himself. This story of the rescue from without shows in the final stages of the adventure the continued operation of the supernatural force assisting the hero. His consciousness having succumbed, the unconscious nevertheless supplies its own balances, and he is borne back into the world from which he came. Instead of holding on to and saving his ego, as in the pattern of the magic flight, he loses it, and yet, through grace, it is returned. This brings us to the final crisis of the round, to which the whole miraculous excursion has been but a prelude. The paradoxical, supremely difficult threshold crossing of the hero's return from the mystic realm into the land of common day. Whether rescued from without, driven from within, or gently carried along by the guiding divinities, he has yet to re-enter with his boon the long-forgotten atmosphere where men, who are fractions, imagine themselves to be complete. He has yet to confront society with his ego-shattering, life-redeeming elixir, and take the return blow of reasonable queries, hard resentment, and good people at a loss to comprehend. The crossing of the return threshold.
Now, this threshold of return is no joke. It is very often more difficult than the quest. Here you were following your lure, the allure of the unknown. Now you're going back to something that you had left behind. It's a little bit like getting back into a wet bathing suit. There are a couple of junctures possible. Let me imagine, for instance, a young man from Wisconsin whose father was a rather stern cattle butcher or something like that. He thought this an unlikely life for himself, so he goes in quest. He comes to California, let's say, and with the aid of a number of nymphs, goes through a long season of quest for his own spirit and his own art and his own inspiration and so forth. And by golly, in the hot baths of Esalen, it comes to him. And this is lovely and fine. And now he's going to go back with what he's found. He's been able to jot a few things down or perhaps make some paintings or something. And he's going back to the world to present them. And he's heard that 57th Street, New York, is the place of all the galleries and all the publishers and all. So he comes with his offering, and they look at it and they say, "So what?" Well, that's a pretty bad jolt. There are three responses he may make. One is, "To hell with them. I'll go back to the hot bath." Stay there. And why not? They don't deserve what you've got. You've found it. It's great. This is called the Pratyeka Buddha, the one who remains a Buddha for himself. Perfectly valid, perfectly standard way. Second way is to look around and just see, well, what do they buy? You have learned something. You are stronger than they. You have been out. You do have a perspective on them. You can give them what they want, full tilt. So go ahead. You can become a commercial artist. You can just say, what do they want? I'm going to give it to them. And you do. The only kind of commercial artist who is to be deeply pitied is the one who says, I'm going to go on writing pot boilers until I've got my pile, and then I'm going to write the book. Well, what he finds, inevitably, is that his style has been determined by his pot-boiling period, and he can't write the book. It has died beneath layers of activity for the society in its own terms. You see what you've done? You've come back, and you've let the society stay where it was. You haven't given them your jewel. And your jewel, it has a way, just as the monsters that follow you had a way, of fading at the daylight level, unless it's fostered.
The two worlds, the divine and the human, can be pictured only as distinct from each other, different as life and death, as day and night. The hero adventures out of the land we know into darkness. There he accomplishes his adventure, or again, is simply lost to us, imprisoned or in danger. And his return is described as coming back out of that yonder zone. Nevertheless, and here is the great key to the understanding of myth and symbol, the two kingdoms are actually one. The realm of the gods is a forgotten dimension of the world we know, and the exploration of that dimension, either willingly or unwillingly, is the whole sense of the deed of the hero. The values and distinctions that in normal life seem important disappear with the terrifying assimilation of the self into what formerly was only otherness. As in the stories of the cannibal ogresses, the fearfulness of this loss of personal individuation can be the whole burden of the transcendental experience for unqualified souls. But the hero soul goes boldly in and discovers the hags converted into goddesses and the dragons into the watchdogs of the gods. There must always remain, however, from the standpoint of normal waking consciousness, a certain baffling inconsistency between the wisdom brought forth from the deep and the prudence usually found to be effective in the light world. Martyrdom is for saints, but the common people have their institutions, and these cannot be left to grow like lilies in the field. The boon brought from the transcendent deep becomes quickly rationalized into non-entity, and the need becomes great for another hero to refresh the word. How teach again, however, what has been taught correctly, but incorrectly learned 1,000,000 times? That is the hero's ultimate difficult task. How render back into light world language the speech-defying pronouncements of the dark? How to translate into terms of yes and no revelations that shatter into meaninglessness at every attempt to define them? How communicate to people who insist on evidence the message of the all-generating void? Many failures attest to the difficulties of this life affirmative threshold. The first problem of the returning hero is to accept as real, after an experience of the soul-satisfying vision of fulfillment, the passing joys and sorrows, banalities, and noisy obscenities of life. Why re-enter such a world? Why attempt to make plausible, or even interesting to men and women consumed with passion, the experience of transcendental bliss? The easy thing is to commit the whole community to the devil and retire again into the heavenly rock dwelling, close the door, and make it fast. The story of Rip Van Winkle is an example of the delicate case of the returning hero. Rip moved into the adventurous realm unconsciously, as we all do every night when we go to sleep. In deep sleep, declare the Hindus, the self is unified and blissful. But though we are refreshed and sustained by these nightly visits to the source darkness, our lives are not reformed by them. We return, like Rip, with nothing to show for the experience but our whiskers. The returning hero, to complete his adventure, must survive the impact of the world. Master of the Two Worlds. Freedom to pass back and forth across the world division, not contaminating the principles of the one with those of the other, yet permitting the mind to know the one by virtue of the other, this is the talent of the master. The cosmic dancer, declares Nietzsche, does not rest heavily on a single spot, but gaily, lightly, turns and leaps from one position to another. It is possible to speak from only one point at a time, but that does not invalidate the insights of the rest. The myths do not often display in a single image the ready transit. Where they do, the moment is a precious symbol, full of import, to be treasured and contemplated. Such a moment was that of the transfiguration of the Christ. From Matthew, Jesus taketh Peter, James, and John, his brother, and bringeth them into an high mountain apart, and was transfigured before them, and his face shone as the sun, and his raiment was white as the light. And behold, there appeared unto them Moses and Elias talking with him. Then answered Peter and said unto Jesus, Lord, it is good for us to be here. If thou wilt, let us make here three tabernacles, one for thee, and one for Moses, and one for Elias. While he yet spoke, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and behold, a voice out of the cloud which said, This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Hear ye him. And when the disciples heard it, they fell on their face, and were sore afraid. And Jesus came and touched them, and said, Arise, and be not afraid. And when they had lifted up their eyes, they saw no man, save Jesus only. And as they came down from the mountain, Jesus charged them, saying, Tell the vision to no man until the Son of Man is risen again from the dead. Here is the whole myth in a moment. Jesus the guide, the way, the vision, and the companion of the return. The disciples are his initiates, not themselves masters of the mystery, yet introduced to the full experience of the paradox of the two worlds in one. Peter was so frightened he babbled. Flesh had dissolved before their eyes to reveal the word. They fell upon their faces, and when they arose, the door again had closed. The individual, through prolonged psychological discipline, gives up completely all attachment to his personal hopes and fears, no longer resists the self-annihilation that is prerequisite to rebirth in the realization of truth, and so becomes ripe at last for the great at-one-ment. His personal ambitions being totally dissolved, he no longer tries to live but willingly relaxes to whatever may come to pass in him. He becomes, that is to say, an anonymity. The law lives in him with his unreserved consent. Many other figures, particularly in the social and mythological contexts of the Orient, who represent this ultimate state of anonymous presence. The sages of the hermit groves and the wandering mendicants who play a conspicuous role in the life and legends of the East. In myth, such figures as the wandering Jew, despised, unknown, yet with a pearl of great price in his pocket, the tattered beggar set upon by dogs, the miraculous mendicant bard whose music stills the heart, or the masquerading god, Wotan, Viracocha, Edshu, these are examples. As the Shankaracharya Vivekachudamani states, sometimes a fool, sometimes a sage, sometimes possessed of regal splendor, sometimes wandering, sometimes honored, sometimes insulted, sometimes unknown, thus lives the man of realization, ever happy with supreme bliss, just as an actor is always a man, whether he puts on the costume of his role or lays it aside, so is the perfect knower of the imperishable always the imperishable, and nothing else. Freedom to live.
How can I get what I have to give to them? Not just what do they want, but how can I use what they want as a gate, as a door for giving what I feel they need? It's a much more compassionate approach. It involves compassion, not resentment, hostility, and violence. You can't give unless you're going to let the barrier drop that you had to put up to get away. All of the requirements are changed in the return. Here, everything that they were was enough to drive you away. But if you're going to come back, you've got to see those things in a kind of perspective. I call this, then, the delivery of your elixir. And the symbology is of the awakened world. What do you have to give? It may be just a suggestion for the elders of the city to knock the buildings in the most beautiful place in the California coast. Or it may be a new religion. Or it may be a whole new inspiration in the arts or whatnot. But that is the circle. And you ought really to try to know what stage of it you're on. And don't try to universalize this for everybody, as though everybody ought to be where you are.
What now is the result of the miraculous passage and return? The battlefield is symbolic of the field of life, where every creature lives on the death of another. A realization of the inevitable guilt of life may so sicken the heart that, like Hamlet or like Arjuna, one may refuse to go on with it. On the other hand, like most of the rest of us, One may invent a false, finally unjustified image of oneself as an exceptional phenomenon in the world, not guilty as others are, but justified in one's inevitable sinning because one represents the good. Such self-righteousness leads to a misunderstanding not only of oneself, but of the nature of both man and the cosmos. The goal of the myth is to dispel the need for such life ignorance by effecting a reconciliation of the individual consciousness with the universal will. And this is effected through a realization of the true relationship of the passing phenomena of time to the imperishable life that lives and dies in all. As the Bhagavad Gita describes it, even as a person casts off worn-out clothes and puts on others that are new, so the embodied self casts off worn-out bodies and enters into others that are new. Weapons cut it not, fire burns it not, water wets it not, the wind does not wither it. This self cannot be cut, nor burnt, nor wetted, nor withered. Eternal, all-pervading, unchanging, immovable, the self is the same forever. Man in the world of action loses his centering in the principle of eternity if he is anxious for the outcome of his deeds. But resting them and their fruits on the knees of the living God, he is released by them as by a sacrifice from the bondages of the sea of death. Again from the Bhagavad Gita, do without attachments the work you have to do, surrendering all action to me, with mind intent on the self, freeing yourself from longing and selfishness, fight unperturbed by grief. Powerful in this insight, calm and free in action, elated that through his hand should flow the grace of Viracocha, the hero is the conscious vehicle of the terrible, wonderful law, whether his work be that of butcher, jockey, or king. The hero is the champion of things becoming, not of things become, because he is. Before Abraham was, I am. He does not mistake apparent changelessness in time for the permanence of being, nor is he fearful of the next moment as destroying the permanent with its change. In the Metamorphosis we read, nothing retains its own form, but nature, the greater renewer, ever makes up forms from forms. Be sure there's nothing perishes in the whole universe. It does but vary and renew its form. Thus, the next moment is permitted to come to pass. When the Prince of Eternity kissed the Princess of the World, her resistance was allayed. A Grimm's fairy tale describes it this way. She opened her eyes, awoke, and looked at him in friendship. Together they came down the stairs, and the king awoke, and the queen, and the entire courtly estate, and all looked at each other with big eyes. And the horses in the court stood up and shook themselves. The hunting dogs jumped and wagged their tails. The pigeons on the roof drew their little heads out from under their wings, looked around, and flew across the fields. The flies on the wall walked again. The fire in the kitchen brightened, flickered, and cooked the dinner. The roast began again to sizzle, and the cook gave the scullery boy a box in the ear that made him yell, and the maid finished plucking the chicken. The Hero Today. The democratic ideal of the self-determining individual, the invention of the power-driven machine, and the development of the scientific method of research have so transformed human life that the long-inherited, timeless universe of symbols has collapsed. In the fateful, epoch-announcing words of Nietzsche's Zarathustra, dead are all the gods. One knows the tale. It has been told a thousand ways. It is the hero cycle of the modern age, the wonder story of mankind's coming to maturity. The spell of the past, the bondage of tradition, was shattered with sure and mighty strokes. The dream web of myth fell away, the mind opened to full waking consciousness, and modern man emerged from ancient ignorance, like a butterfly from its cocoon, or like the sun at dawn from the womb of Mother Night. It is not only that there is no hiding place for the gods from the searching telescope and microscope. There is no such society anymore as the gods once supported. The social unit is not a carrier of religious content, but an economic political organization. Its ideals are not those of the hieratic pantomime, making visible on earth the forms of heaven, but of the secular state, in hard and unremitting competition for material supremacy and resources. Isolated societies no longer exist except as areas to be exploited, and within the progressive societies themselves, every last vestige of the ancient human heritage of ritual, morality, and art is in full decay. The problem of mankind today, therefore, is precisely the opposite to that of men in the comparatively stable periods of those great coordinating mythologies which now are known as lies. Then all meaning was in the group, in the great anonymous forms. Today, no meaning is in the group. All is in the individual. But there, the meaning is absolutely unconscious. One does not know toward what one moves. One does not know by what one is propelled. The lines of communication between the conscious and the unconscious zones of the human psyche have all been cut, and we have been split in two. The hero deed to be wrought is not today what it was in the century of Galileo. Where then there was darkness, now there is light. But also, where light was, there now is darkness. The modern hero deed must be that of questing to bring to light again the lost Atlantis of the coordinated soul. Obviously, this work cannot be wrought by turning back or away from what has been accomplished by the modern revolution, for the problem is nothing if not that of rendering the modern world spiritually significant, or rather, phrasing the same principle the other way round, nothing if not that of making it possible for men and women to come to full human maturity through the conditions of contemporary life. Indeed, these conditions themselves are what have rendered the ancient formulae ineffective, misleading, and even pernicious. The community today is the planet, not the bounded nation. Hence the patterns of projected aggression, which formerly served to coordinate the in-group, now can only break it into factions. The national idea, with the flag as totem, is today an aggrandizer of the nursery ego, not the annihilator of an infantile situation. And the numerous saints of this anti-cult, namely the patriots whose ubiquitous photographs, draped with flags, serve as official icons, are precisely the local threshold guardians whom it is the first problem of the hero to surpass. Nor can the great world religions, as at present understood, meet the requirement, for they have become associated with the causes of the factions as instruments of propaganda and self-congratulation. The universal triumph of the secular state has thrown all religious organizations into such a definitely secondary and finally ineffectual position that religious pantomime is hardly more today than a sanctimonious exercise for Sunday morning, whereas business ethics and patriotism stand for the remainder of the week. Such a monkey holiness is not what the functioning world requires. Rather, a transmutation of the whole social order is necessary, that through every detail and act of secular life, the vitalizing image of the universal God-man, who is actually in all of us, may be somehow made known to the consciousness. And this is not a work that consciousness itself can achieve. The whole thing is being worked out on another level, through what is bound to be a long and very frightening process, not only in the depths of every living psyche in the modern world, but also on those titanic battlefields into which the whole planet has lately been converted. But there is one thing we may know, namely, that as the new symbols become visible, they will not be identical in the various parts of the globe. The circumstances of local life, race, and tradition must all be compounded in the effective forms. Therefore, it is necessary for men to understand and be able to see that through various symbols, the same redemption is revealed. Truth is one, we read in the Vedas. The sages call it by many names. A single song is being inflected through all the colorations of the human choir. General propaganda for one or another of the local solutions, therefore, is superfluous, or much rather, a menace. The way to become human is to learn to recognize the lineaments of God in all the wonderful modulations of the face of man. With this, we come to the final hint of what the specific orientation of the modern hero task must be, and discover the real cause for the disintegration of all of our inherited religious formula. The center of gravity, that is to say, of the realm of mystery and danger, has definitely shifted. For the primitive hunting peoples of those remotest human millenniums, when the saber-toothed tiger, the mammoth, and the lesser presences of the animal kingdom were the primary manifestations of what was alien, the source at once of danger and of sustenance for those primitive peoples, the great human problem was to become linked psychologically to the task of sharing the wilderness with these beings. An unconscious identification took place, and this was finally rendered conscious in the half-human, half-animal figures of the mythological totem ancestors. The animals became the tutors of humanity. Through acts of literal imitation, such as appear today only on children's playgrounds or in the madhouse, an effective annihilation of the human ego was accomplished and society achieved a cohesive organization. Similarly, for the tribes supporting themselves on plant food, the life rituals of planting and reaping were identified with those of human procreation, birth, and progress to maturity. Both the plant and the animal worlds, however, were in the end brought under social control, whereupon the great field of instructive wonder shifted to the skies, and mankind enacted the great pantomime of the sacred moon king, the sacred sun king, the hieratic planetary state, and the symbolic festivals of the world-regulating spheres. Today, all of these mysteries have lost their force. Their symbols are no longer of interest to our psyche. The notion of a cosmic law, which all existence serves and to which man himself must bend, has long since passed through the preliminary mystical stages represented in the old astrology and is now simply accepted in mechanical terms as a matter of course. The descent of the occidental sciences from the heavens to the earth, from 17th century astronomy to 19th century biology, and their concentration today at last on humankind itself in 20th century anthropology and psychology, mark the path of a prodigious transfer of the focal point of human wonder. Not the animal world, not the plant world, not the miracle of the spheres, but man himself is now the crucial mystery. Man is that alien presence with whom the forces of egoism must come to terms, through whom the ego is to be crucified and resurrected, and in whose image society is to be reformed. Humankind understood, however, not as I, but as thou, for the ideals and temporal institutions of no tribe, race, continent, social class, or century can be the measure of the inexhaustible and multifariously wonderful divine existence that is the life in all of us. The modern hero, the modern individual who dares to heed the call and seek the mansion of that presence with whom it is our whole destiny to be atoned, cannot, indeed must not, wait for his community to cast off its slough of pride, fear, rationalized avarice, and sanctified misunderstanding. And so, every one of us shares the supreme ordeal, carries the cross of the Redeemer, not in the bright memories of his tribe's great victories, but in the silences of his personal despair. It is not society that is to guide and save the creative hero, but precisely the reverse. Live, Nietzsche tells us, as though the day were here.
Now, to conclude, there's one other Grail romance of this time, and this is the Quest of Del St. Graal, the one in which Galahad plays the role. I just want to conclude this with a little episode from that romance. When one follows the way of the Oriental Guru tells one what to do, how to do it, and the aim and end are known. Not so in the West. The big factor in the Occidental heritage, which does not appear in the Oriental, is the accent on the unique capacity and qualities of each individual. All the Buddhas are alike, and in the Oriental tradition, anything like a personal inflection, a personal quirk, a personal inspiration is a defect. Here, that is what is to be brought to flower. In the human brain alone, there are 18,000 million cells. If no two human hands are alike, no two human beings are alike. And so what is good for Tom is not good for Harry. You've got to find your own way. And so here's the episode from the Quest. The knights are in Arthur's dining hall. The Grail appears, covered with a veil. Everyone is in awe. It withdraws. And then Sir Gawain, Arthur's nephew, stands up and says,
I propose a vow that we shall all go in quest of that grail to behold it with unveiled. Next morning they set forth, but these are the words that struck me and that I offer as the concluding sign here. They thought it would be a disgrace to go forth in a group. Each entered the forest of adventure at that point which he himself had chosen, and where it was darkest, and there was no way or path, because where there is a way or path, it is someone else's footsteps. Each has to find his own. And in this romance, whenever a knight sees a path that someone else has followed and tries to follow that, he goes altogether astray. And this is what gives to our Occidental world its initiative, its creative quality, and its romance. We are seeking that which never was on land or sea, that fulfillment of our own unique person, which it is our own business to bring to pass. And so with the secularization of our social life, where no one is telling us, you've got to believe this, you've got to believe that, we're left each to find his own beliefs. Nobody can give you a mythology. You don't have one. You are in the process of making it, and your life will be your mythology. The images that mean something to you, you'll find in your dreams, you'll find in your visions, you find in your creative work, you find in your action. And you find out what they are after you've passed them. So this is a very exciting world we find ourselves in. With the moonwalk and all, the world has moved into a new era. It is an era comparable historically to that which arose in the 9th millennium BC when agriculture and animal husbandry were invented. The whole life of man was changed. That was followed by the rise of cities and the development of the great monumental civilizations, each with its little province. But now when you look from the moon and see the earth rise over the moon horizon, there are no more provinces on this planet of ours. There are no more separate peoples. There are no more chosen or rejected peoples of God or anything else. It is one mankind, and the individual cannot be initiated into a group mythologically. He is being initiated only into his relationship to the entire system. It's a totally new quest. It's a totally new universe we're in. And where it's going, I won't even say God knows.